Welcome to this episode of What Will I Be When I Grow Up? Our guest today is James Barton, who is Director of Admissions at Amanda Portman Woodman, MPW. Having worked at MPW for 12 years, James is a huge believer in the sector and the virtues of a different approach to education. He has a wealth of experience from educational policy to interviewing, coaching, and advising students on subject choices, university applications, and careers. James is also the author of the popular Getting Into Medical School, Getting Into Veterinary School, and Getting Into Engineering Guides, and sits annually on medical school panels. Alongside giving presentations both domestically and internationally on a range of educational topics, James is a contributing editor for varying publications and has given talks for Power 2 Academy and TEDx. James read for a BA in Classical Archaeology and Ancient History at the University of Warwick before gaining an MA in acting and working for many years as a professional actor. Welcome to the show, James. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
Good, thanks. So if you've listened to the podcast, which I hope you have, you probably know that I usually ask my guests to tell me a little bit about themselves and a little bit about their childhood influences. Would you start with that? Tell us a bit about, you know, school growing up and what some of your influences were.
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite interesting hearing the blurb back to start with, because you sort of lose sight a little bit of some of the things you've done in your life so far, and then hearing them back, is that me? Yes, it is me. I grew up in Yorkshire, so I was born in Yorkshire, and we moved around a little bit when I was growing up, so down in south of England, in Italy, then came back, and very much spent most of my life as a Yorkshire boy. Up in basically just fields, up in North Yorkshire, in a tiny little city called Ripon. It's only a city because it's got a cathedral, but apart from that, it's not got too much else there. So my upbringing was very honest in lots of respects, to the extent that it was all about being a child, as opposed to being a child stuck to a screen, and you got to play and you got to explore and you got to do this, that and the other. And that sort of took me through my schooling career, which was a bit blighted because I had one track when I was going through school, which was I was always going down a professional rugby playing career. That was what I had in my mind. And then pre-season training when I was 15 years old, someone landed on my back and I broke my leg so horrifically, I spent 9 months in hospital. So I pretty much lost my GCSE year to homeschooling. And that led to a readjustment, I suppose, in terms of what I actually wanted to do with my future and those sorts of things. So my upbringing very much shaped how I then approached and went forward into the next stage of life. You asked about influences. I'm almost singularly obsessed with stories. And I think every man probably is always going to be Peter Pan growing up. I almost genuinely believed I was Peter Pan for the longest period of my life, and I probably still need to be dissuaded that I'm not now. I always like to start any talk by saying, look, when I was growing up, I used to want to be Indiana Jones. Not because I can't differentiate between what is fiction and what is real and all of these sorts of things, but because I just loved that idea of doing it. So it led me to go off to university and to study that and X, Y, and Z. But stories are my influences. Classical stories, adventure stories, stories that spark and fire the imagination, because I think imagination is so powerful that that's what I try to bleed into every aspect of life, I suppose. Life, career, personal life, those sorts of things from now. So those are my influences. I was also heavily, heavily influenced by my grandparents, who I found amazing people growing up, because they come from that generation that gave so much, did so many different things, and all of them did so many different and rewarding things within their particular life that you are influenced a bit by that generation. And so my grandparents very much formed a major part of my upbringing in that respect too.
It's really interesting that you were able to sort of pivot out of, you know, you talked about potentially being very good at rugby and then having to shift that at a very young age. And I suppose you had to make a decision that it wasn't going to be a career in sports. Is that fair? Is that what happened?
Yeah, no, it's completely fair. I mean, good at rugby, it depends on who you ask. I mean, me certainly. But no, you do have to make a readjustment when all of a sudden everyone... Rugby is one of those sports whereby there's a growth spurt and everyone gets very big around you. And the moment you have a weakness within there, which is a significant weakness, it does put you on the back foot. And don't get me wrong, I've been back and I play rugby all my life, even up to recently, but just not at that level. And what it does when you're lying there for that period of time is you're forced to try and start thinking sensibly and practically, even at an age where sense and practicality and logic don't necessarily go hand in hand, but you are forced to take a slightly different view on the world. I had two other loves. I mean, one was flying and one was acting. within that. And when I was told that I was colorblind, so I couldn't go and be a fighter pilot in the RAF, so I picked acting almost by necessity within there. That was a route that I wanted to explore, but I wasn't allowed to do that until I'd been through the university system and actually got something credible under my belt first to actually work out if that was the right path. So sense and having to grow up were rather enforced upon me at that particular age. I might not have grown up still for another 10 years beyond that, but actually practical thinking I certainly had in my wheelhouse.
Who really is grown up? I don't know. I don't think I am.
I don't know. I mean, I don't feel it, do you? It's a weird one. There are days where you wake up and just go, I just want to be a child right now. I want to run down the street.
Like, who put me in charge of anything?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. I always ask that. But I was going to go back to the Indiana Jones thing because it made me laugh. You're the second person I've interviewed in the space of a week who talked about Indiana Jones.
No,
the last person,
really?
Yes. Oh, the last person
there's
I interviewed.
Two of us.
There's two of you. One is a Cuban historian who specializes in global history of the slave trade. And he talked about how, you know, having that interest in archives and true stories inspired him to pursue a degree in history and then subsequently going on to do a master's and a PhD. Mm. And I just kind of thought that was a really interesting comparison. I guess men find Indiana Jones inspiring. Is that fair? Am I being gendered?
I don't know. You've made it massively more intellectual than maybe I ever had it. And your previous guest certainly would be more suited to that career than I. I think there is an element to that. I think it's that classic adventure story that is in there. And it's this fascination with the past and what the past actually had before, which I find deeply intriguing. And what I found when I did my degree and actually what took me to acting and throughout everything now is you never have such a thing as a truly original story. Everything we ever have comes from something before, and actually tracing its origin roots back, I found so, not romantic within there, but so thrilling to actually be able to find those cross connections. And actually, I love it nowadays when you're working with people and you actually make the scales drop from people's eyes when you go, well, it's that, but it's also that, and it's been this before. Everything we have is just a rehash of something that's gone previous. And I love that idea.
You've sort of bled a little bit into the second question that I had, which was why classical archaeology and ancient history? I think we've kind of covered that a little bit. But, you know, why did you choose Warwick, for example, as the place to go for that degree? And maybe if you could tell us a little bit about whether the sort of expectations of Indiana Jones archaeology versus the reality of studying in Coventry.
Yeah.
Hey, I lived here for 18 months. I know.
Davina, I will not be rude about Coventry then.
No, neither will I. I worked at Warwick University for 18 months. I loved it. Thought it was brilliant. So I'm just curious about the kind of match between what we build up in our heads of what university is going to be like and then what it actually is like.
Of course. I mean, there's two things. Firstly, I mean, when I picked the degree title for all of this, I mean, yes, there was a weird fascination within that, and it was immediately dispelled when I went to university itself. It was at university I absolutely realised that I only wanted to pretend. There was absolutely nothing in the archaeology side of things that really gripped me. I mean, it's a great pursuit. It's a fascinating science, but it's a science in a way that I wasn't that geared up for. But it was the actual ancient history and the classical story side of things that resonated with me a lot. And I think that is a really important point for anyone when they look at universities, is always go in with a bit more of an open mind and don't just see the degree title as it is now, because I guarantee when you're there, you're going to find what actually inspires you and influences you. And more often than not, the degree title that you enter with is not the degree title on your piece of paper when you leave, because you've actually amalgamated or you've built in other modules, or it's become economics and sort of geography. It's whatever it is. You've changed it based upon your openness to actually be ready to find what interests you when you are actually there. When I chose Warwick, so you apply to university when you actually have the traditional six choices that you could go for. And at that point, I'd had all these, I actually tried to remember the other day which ones I applied for, but I had my other five in there, and Warwick was number six as far as I was concerned based upon the list. It was looking for that. But I then went to visit Warwick. And when I visited Warwick, you just find this synergy there. You find this energy that it's giving you. You find that you actually feel like you could belong here. And it became my number one place just from actually having gone to visit it. And I loved everything about it, not because it's pretty. You went, it's an eyesore from the 50s, 60s. I mean, it's a concrete block, as you say, just outside of Coventry, which has its own reputation. But it had a campus that was frankly sprawling with all these different opportunities and experiences. It had the Warwick Arts Centre, which is the biggest one out of London. It had this enormous great library there, the sports centres, the rugby, which was always still a big thing for me. I loved the fact that the halls of residence all surrounded the student union, which was before they knocked it down, but it was the biggest one that they had there at the time. It just had a great vibe about it. And I also, and this is something I still try and encourage people to do, is look at where you'll stay in year two and year three. So yes, you have Coventry, but you also have Royal Leamington Spa right on the doorstep, which was a great town. And you do go and have a look at these places and just check that you could live there and feel comfortable living there in the second couple of years. And it just felt right in that respect. As far as the course goes, it was a bizarre one because it was the only course. So universities, as we all know, don't really interview so much. But at that time, it was the only one that bothered to actually give you a meeting with the departments. And I remember sitting with the head of department at that moment in time, was asked a couple of questions, and I actually felt like I was being engaged with, and I felt that was a really important selling point for them as well. So it wasn't just the university sell, it very much also focused on them trying to work out if you were right for the course, as well as, you know, interviewing them back, as it were, there. And that meant a lot to me at that particular moment in time.
Oh, I know the Royal Leamington Spa. I live there.
Yeah,
no, it's funny because I worked at Warwick for 18 months in the international office after I finished my MA. And the campus, the way you describe it, it's spot on. I think the reason why students love it so much is that there's a certain energy to the place that I think you really struggle to recreate in city universities or more urban settings. And I just think the university does a really great job of making sure the students are well taken care of, whether they're living on or off campus. So I completely understand why that sort of campus tour open day experience would have nailed it.
I do actually think you're 100% right there. It's a truly fantastic university in different ways. Yes, it's a centre of academic excellence and those sorts of things. But I love the fact of it's almost symptomatic of how many conferences are attracted to there and how many world speakers are attracted to there. It's their outreach that's trying to actually bring other influence and other opportunity onto the campus, which is also invaluable for students within that respect too. And the links, as you rightly say, with the close accommodation centres around like Leamington, like Coventry and all of these sorts of things, means that you don't feel out of place there. You don't feel unsafe there. You feel very much like you are living and being part of a community even beyond the campus itself. So yeah, I do have a lot of time and a lot of respect for Warwick. I've only been back once since, and it was so strange. It was one of those 10-year reunions, 15-year reunions. I can't remember what it was now. But going back to it, it was a very strange experience to be back there because of how familiar it was. It didn't feel unfamiliar, even though it's been rebuilt. There's lots of other things around it. It was almost immediately stepping back into your home, in a way, if that's not too cliche to say. But yeah.
No, that's really nice. I mean, I think lots of Warwick graduates feel the same way about the university experience. But you sort of mentioned this earlier, that you wanted to be an actor, but I guess, was it family pressure that made you need to do something more sensible? No, the right word?
I think every family always wants you to just have a backup plan within all that. My family were remarkably supportive over more or less any of my idiocies along the way in life, and this was certainly one of them. But what they did say, and it absolutely makes sense to me, and it made sense to me then, albeit under a little bit of resistance, but it certainly makes sense to me now, and it's what I'll say to anyone, which is you have to have something else there for any eventuality that comes along. So if it was the rugby example, breaking your leg, you needed something behind you in order to be able to move on and do something different after that. Well, if you go straight from school to drama school, I genuinely believe you're not prepared for what that profession actually is. After university, I went and I did my MA in drama school at that particular moment in time. And I would contest that even coming out of that and working as a few years for an actor, I wasn't ready for it, which is why I took a step out of the acting world at that point, because there's still a great amount of growing up that I had to do, but also it allows you into a false world, into this belief that everything is just going to be fine, you're going to make it, and all of these, which you have to have. But at the same time, it doesn't allow the other bit that comes through, which says, well, what if you don't? So in that respect, I was extremely grateful for having the degree under my belt in there as well. One, because I love learning, and I love the idea of always pushing yourself and challenging yourself, and I didn't want to be single-tracked. But two, it was hugely important to have that. And yes, a little bit of family pressure, or at least family common sense, was necessary at a time, which now in later life, obviously, I was very grateful for. But I'm glad I did both. I'm glad I went to university, and I'm glad I went to drama school after university as well. It's also an interesting one nowadays that I'm going to resoundingly be contacted by drama schools after this, telling me I'm doing them a disservice, but you get picked up more from doing university drama now than you do through the drama school system, because university drama offers you so many opportunities. Shock horror, but it does. They offer you so many opportunities. Take Warwick, for example, and we're not just salespeople for Warwick, of course, but the Warwick Arts Centre there has that enormous great arts centre, which is a nationally reviewed venue. And the amount of student work that goes through these places, from being on stage to the backstage nowadays, and the support that the university gives to students in that respect, is phenomenal. And so the encouragement to people who want to go down that route is go and experience it at university first, because you might find that drama school, and they are wonderful, might become superfluous, because ultimately you've got everything you wanted to achieve through actually doing it through university whilst getting your degree. So different ways to doing things within all of that.
So can you tell us a bit about that drama school experience? You know, what is studying for an Emmy in acting like? What do you learn? What did you like best?
Yeah, absolutely. It was, you know, it's a year I'd never give up, because it was a very necessary one to have. And I'm glad I had the drama school experience, because it was almost everything I thought it would be in terms of the regimented side of things, lots and lots of classes, all quite uniform in terms of the way it was. I learned some things that year. I didn't learn what I was walking into, I suppose, within that. So the acting classes were interesting. You learned techniques, and it was amazing to work with professionals who have, you know, worked their way through their career in the RSC and through the film circuits and all of these. And you do learn from those people almost by osmosis. You learn from those particular people. Where drama school I do find limiting, and it was only a year, and we were older, but I do find it limiting, is it doesn't prepare you for when you come out. Okay. And I do think there was probably more of an element of that required in there. So you actually coast through that particular year, enjoying your techniques, doing this and that, getting some nice experiences. You may be a little starved of experience, but at the same time, you enjoy what it is that you're doing. But you are living in a bubble for when you come out the other side. So I do want anyone who ever goes down that route to have done something first, so that when you are a little bit older and a little bit more mature, you know how to bring yourself out that bubble with a view of what's the other side in order to move forward. All of that said, on that drama school year, drama school is a phenomenal experience, from the audition process of actually having to get through. There's a great sense of reward when you come the other side of it, because the numbers, the applicant numbers versus the places is, you know, desperately imbalanced. So actually you get a great feeling when you get onto it. Working with other people and staying in touch with those people the other side to see what people actually end up doing, or whether you recognize them in something, or whether they've gone into another career. That's always wonderful within there as well. I used to love various things to do with that. I used to love stage combat. Stage combat, I think, became every boy's, well, not even boys. I mean, this is the crazy thing about it. The girls were better than the boys at stage combat, which was frightening in so many respects, how good ladies can be with a dagger when you're crossing swords. But, you know, the stage combat was amazing within there. I used to love the text work. So I was never a Shakespeare purist, but more of a modern drama person within there. And I used to love all this work we did with Pinter. I met some of the most unbelievable names of the 20th century in terms of acting and drama through that. And one thing I found interesting as well is the fact you had to work there. You attached yourself to a theatre while you were there. So you had to work in front of house, or, you know, either as an usher or, you know, a greeter on the bar or what have you. And, you know, I was sort of meeting anyone and everyone who was there. And just by talking to those people, they give you nuggets of advice. You've got this, you've got that. I found that completely invaluable as well. But it actually goes back to the previous point. So I met Harold Pinter when, just in his later years, we were doing a play at the Trafalgar Studios, which was The Dumbwaiter. Wonderful play with Jason Isaacs and Lee Evans in at the time. They were brilliant. It was mesmeric in terms of what it was. But I actually got the opportunity to show Pinter to his seat. So I was the greeter. I was showing him to his seat. And the Trafalgar Studios is that one which is very steeply raked inside, and he was a very old, very sick man at this moment in time with his wife and all of this. And I was walking him up the stairs, and he was always known as the angry man of the theatre, and you're always aware of this. And he sort of turned to me as we were walking up, and he said, "Are you trying to kill me?" And I was like, "No, absolutely not. No, I am now the death of Harold Pinter. This can't be it." And actually, he was really nice because he had a wry smile on his face, and he sort of put me at his rest, and we sort of walked to see. And he said, "Well, what is it you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm trained to be an actor," and all of these sorts of things. And it goes back to my previous point in the way he just gave me one word, which was, well, not one word, one phrase. He said, "Have a backup plan." And I took it personally, to the extent of going, "What is it? Is it the way I look? Is it the way I had a shower before I came tonight, Harold. I mean, I'm absolutely on point here." But it was not that. It's more the fact that he was just saying, just be aware of who you are. And if you've actually got something else under your belt, it makes you more intelligent. It makes you more aware and receptive on stage. And a lot of all the things with acting is all about how you associate it to real life. And so if you are more grounded in real life, the better it is. And that's what drama school doesn't do. What it does do, though, is teach you wonderful techniques and gives you networking opportunities that you can't get anywhere else, which I think is a very long answer, Davina. I'm sorry about that.
No, I think it's great, because I used to work at the University of the Arts London, which, as you know, Drama Centre is a part of. And, you know, not just working with people who were applying for acting school, but also people applying for degrees in art and design across a range of disciplines. And one of the things that we would always get feedback on was the lack of preparation for the real world. And, you know, when we spoke to alumni who, even if they'd gone on to successfully build careers as artists or designers, would say exactly the same thing. No one prepared me for the real world. No one told me how to set up a business, how to make money from my work. I spent a lot of time being taken advantage of. And so I think this is definitely something that within the arts, you know, across disciplines, whether it's music or theatre or, I don't know, filmmaking, graphic design, we do need to have the skills to go out there and get jobs, not just get jobs, but like not be taken advantage of, to be able to make money and to use your skills and for your skills to be valued. Yeah. So, yeah, no, I mean, it's an entirely valid point. And I hope, you know, over time, as art and design schools or theatre schools, whatever, think about how they can best equip their students, this is one of the things that comes to mind.
It is a really interesting, very topical point, particularly among educationalists nowadays as well, for the right reasons, which is cross connections, because it's all very well us putting the expectation on the drama school to say, you've got to do this, or the art school to say, you've got to teach awareness. Having said that, teaching that stuff's actually quite difficult. What that should come from is just broadening people's scope, having more outreach, having more opportunities outside, or making people go and do something in a different walk of life, or learning something different along the way, or whatever it might be, because you're going to pick up skills, soft skills, from having done that will just naturally become useful to you. I always find that a slightly better way of working than just telling someone exactly what it's going to be like and what they have to do, versus allowing them to experience it for themselves and to take the parts that they find relevant. And the reason I like this as a point is universities nowadays, particularly when you're trying to get people into university, and we do a lot of work on that, is actually getting them to see subjects and how they interconnect with other subjects. Even if they don't interconnect, you're just still taking it. And universities are hot on this now. If you can actually impress that upon them in your application itself, that you can see the cross connection. It's the old Oxbridge interview adage in all of this, in the fact that, have you peaked by the time you finish your A-levels? Or have you still got that intellectual curiosity and something else to give from there, which is a very strange thing to think that you peak at the end of your A-levels, but it really is, what else can you bring when you get there? Are you profoundly curious and interested in the subject to whatever border that takes you to, or are you literally just now walking your way through a degree to a job? And the former is so much more relevant in so many respects, and it goes to this soft skills idea. I think in every walk of life, that's what we should be doing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. A couple of months ago, I read this book called Range by this guy called David Epstein, and he talks about that, exactly that, like how, don't peak too soon, guys, you know, there's a whole lifetime ahead of you, like don't specialize too early, don't, you know, pick a niche and roll with it forever and ever and ever. Always be open to the possibility of cross-learning between disciplines and be able to use skill sets that you learn in one space in another space, which is a perfect point for us to move on to in terms of the next question, because you are now director of admissions at MPW, because it's an interesting pivot from acting, with MPW being a really brilliant sort of school for students doing, you know, GCSEs, A-levels, etc. So can you tell us how you moved from being an actor into working in education?
Absolutely. And in fact, it's even deeper than that, I suppose. From the acting side of things, this is at the stage where I needed to ground myself a little bit more. Took a very random segue to thinking that was the right route by going to the city straight away afterwards. And I worked in recruitment, which was not a way of growing up. If anything, it's a way of regressing back a stage. But you know what? I learned a lot from that experience as well. And that was tough. But what it then was, I suddenly got an opportunity to go in to a place called MPW because they needed a bit of gap filling because a drama teacher was sick at the start of the year or what have you. And I never taught. And I'm going to just say this now, I'm not a teacher in no way. There are people who can teach, are wonderful people, and they have my utmost respect. That wasn't me. It was not my calling in life. But I went along and I did this. And I think very quickly they worked out I couldn't teach. But at the same time, what they did was it opened up other doors and other opportunities. So I ended up finding myself in education as opposed to ever wanting to get there. But I am singularly glad that I made my way into education because it's a world beyond any other. It's not just about the classroom. It's about development beyond that particular stage. And I find it very interesting. And I worked, I say worked because I still work at MPW, but I actually combine it with something else, which I'll come to in a minute. But throughout that time I've been there, I've traveled a lot. I've traveled a lot internationally to go and give talks and to try and actually upsell the virtues of the English education system overseas and to bring it over here, because it is something I truly believe in. I think is a wonderful system in order to be able to do that. So I worked at MPW for a very long period of time, and I stayed there for a long period, even with little sabbaticals along the way, because I believe in the place. I believe in the product. I believe in the development of it. It was very, not because of me by any stretch, but it was a very different place from when I started through to now. In fact, it's had so many stages of development through different owners, but different ideas and those sorts of things. But it's always been true to itself and that original founding ethos of the place, which is to focus on the individual and actually take a little bit more time to work out who this person is, what makes them tick and what they actually want to do, and then help them get there. I love that idea for the longest period of time. And I also really like interviewing people, because you take some time to actually, and MPW is not right for everyone by any stretch of the imagination, nor should any school be, but actually in that interview process you actually get to guide people. Yes, help them. Yes, recruit them. There is a job in there as well. But also, if it's not right, just to give some advice along the way within that. And actually, having pivoted all the way from acting to education, I've gone also back into film. So I work alongside being the admissions director there still, and interviewing for MPW, and as an ambassador for them, I am a film producer too. So I'm now combining, because the education world and the film world match up hand in hand very neatly every single day of the week. And it's an interesting sort of career now to have two strands to it in that respect. So I'm sort of now at the stage I combine what maybe I wanted a long time ago with what I actually do right now.
Super cool. I have a side hustle too. I have a literary agency. So when I'm not speaking with students or doing this, we're trying to work with Malaysian writers to bring their stories to Western audiences, but not writing for the white gaze, which I think historically has been the way Asian writers have been forced to write if they're going to sell their books. But we want to kind of bring authentic Asian stories to the rest of the world. So yeah, no, I know it's interesting to combine interests.
Can I say, that's amazing. Yeah, that is amazing and absolutely the right thing to do. And I love the fact you've got two pursuits that you have within there. But yeah, I really love what you're trying to do there, which is to give people opportunity and allow them to have the voice that they need to have as opposed to the voice they're told to have. And that does match in a lot with the film side of things in terms of what we're doing. It's like being an artist, isn't it? In terms of, are you trying to paint because it's something you want to paint and it means something to you? Or are you painting because if you paint it that way, it's going to sell and you're going to make money within there? And you hope for the middle, but it's like, which side are you actually falling down on?
And I think especially for Asian writers writing in English, it's almost like a very specific space that's been created for them that is exotic. And just you kind of need to move away from that, you know, just because I'm brown doesn't mean I'm exotic. Like that needs to stop. but yeah, anyway, I digress.
No, but it is really interesting. It's really interesting.
I mean, obviously, otherwise I wouldn't do it because my team know this about me. If it's not fun, I'm not doing it. That's my motto in life. If it's not,
you know,
fun,
what we only get one life, don't we? So why not have a bit of fun in doing it as well?
Yeah,
that's why I like telling stories, because you know it is all about having a little bit of fun there as well.
No, absolutely. So we have to get back to what you do with interviews, right? Because you said that you like interviewing students, but you're also on panels for medical school, and you've written extensively on, like, you know, getting into medical school or veterinary school and competitive courses in general. Yeah. What would you say some of the key things universities are looking for when they're assessing applications?
Honesty and interests within there. I've found over the course of a long period of time in all these sorts of things is that when you get someone to try and talk about themselves, all they want to do is list every single award or achievement or anything, because no one really knows exactly what it is that they're actually trying to say. It's like you've got a personal statement, so therefore it should all be about you, X, Y, and Z. What I find universities are far more interested in, and by their own admission, as much as anything else, this isn't just my personal opinion, but they want you to actually sell why you actually want to do the course. It's an academic argument, as it were, without it being an essay. It's an argument as to why you want to do this particular course and what have you done to research it. And in doing that, you are, by very nature of the way you're writing, upselling yourself and convincing them that that is what they are looking for within there, as opposed to just saying, I'm this, 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 and this. That this, 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 and this is interesting. But I've always used an analogy of a human body. Do you ever remember a child game where you used to have to draw the body and you sort of drew the head first, then you folded over the paper at the neck, and then you pass it to the next person, that person then draws the body without having seen the head, and then here's the game. So then you then fold it over, you pass it to the next person, that person draws the legs, they fold it over, and then the next person draws the feet, and then you pass it in. The other person afterwards will write one single sentence at the bottom, having looked at the entire picture. And all of it will look very different because it's someone else writing in those sorts of bits. But if you break that up like a personal statement should work very much like a human body. And we can write five different sections in isolation, but all of them actually give you a sense as to how much of that space is relevant to which particular bit the university is interested in. So that awards and achievements and all that, if you use the human body, is about your ankles and your feet. It's 15% of the actual personal statement itself. And once you start getting people to visualize it in terms of silly examples and things like that, you get more of a sense as to the flow towards these things. So in terms of what university is looking for, there's no one definable way to do anything, but it is a clear structure that you've got to somehow bring into play, which is convince me why, tell me why you want to do this course and what you've done to go about doing it. That's hurdle number one. Once we've cleared hurdle number one, we then go on with everything else from there. Honesty is important because in life we should all be honest. You're allowed creative license to your personal statements, you're allowed creative license to your applications, particularly when universities are no longer interviewing people, but to a certain degree of point in the fact that it does stick out like a sore thumb, whether it's you writing or someone else writing within there. And universities are much better than this than people think, in terms of they know when a student's writing it, they know whether a student is writing it for them, they know whether a student is pitching too high. They know, obviously, when a student pitches too late. So being true to yourself is also massively important within that. And one other point, sorry, forgive me on the ramble nature of this, but it is also very important to try and write it for the audience you're writing it for. So also, as much as everyone says, be true to yourself, just be honest, just be you. True, but there's someone across the other side of the table, and that's the person you've got to try and convince. So not play the person, but appeal to the person. And in order to do that, you will have taken your time to know who that person is across the other side of the table too. I often deeply annoy people on talks with this example. I think I've got to move on from this in life, but The Wolf of Wall Street, do you know that, you know the film? And you know, there's that wonderful Tell Me the Pen example.
All Malaysians know this film because our tax money was used to make it.
Really? I did not know that. Well,
is this a story for another time? I might go on a very long rant if I start, so I shan't. Please tell me the quote from The Wolf of Wall Street, though.
It's not even a quote. It's something that's deeply used in the city still. It's just this. I had this in my interview for the recruitment job in the city, where this guy, and this was years before The Wolf of Wall Street came out, and he did actually genuinely ask me to sell him this pen. And it's the example he's used in the film. But it goes so Hollywoodized in terms of what that is and all of these, and you can break it down in different ways. But the way that I was taught to define it over the course of that was, you have different types of people. You have the people who will just try and sell you the object in front, give you a lot of superficial statements about it, and therefore not really connect with what they're trying to do. You then have the next person above that who might try and create a bit of a myth or a story about it. Well, this was Lady Gaga's pen. And for some people, they will buy that because we live in a sycophantic world in many respects, and people will go for that consumerism within that. But the best people, the best salesmen within there, forget about the pen completely, and they just have a chat with the other person. And once you have a chat with that person, you get to know them, you know their life, you know what they do. You might actually then work out if they wanted that pen in the first place. And if they did, try and sell to the points that they've actually given you, versus they might not want the pen, and therefore this is a completely pointless sales pitch. That's the way we should all approach our university applications, in a way, is know the person that you're actually trying to sell to, and then make it relevant to them. Or you've worked out that this isn't the place for you, and therefore not. And if you take your time to do that research, actually these university applications become a whole lot better and a whole lot easier, and might actually mean you have a good 3 years, as opposed to just going somewhere that's not right for you and you've pitched in the wrong way because it's just something that you've heard of. So that's that. But having now disappointed you with bringing The Wolf of Wall Street up in our conversation, I'm going to have to take you offline at some point and hear your rant on the Malaysian tax system. But there we go.
Yeah, it's a long story. But if you Google it, you'll find it, because there was a huge scandal sometime, I think it was 2014 or 2015, where the then Malaysian Prime Minister stole $700 million of the taxpayers' money. And some of that money was funneled into the making of The Wolf of Wall Street, because his stepson was one of the producers of The Wolf of Wall Street. Yeah.
Wow. So, I did not know that. Well, that was less of a rant and more nice contextualization. So I appreciate that.
If you want the rant, we'll have to meet offline for sure. That will take a while.
I also have a slightly guilty secret on this call, but my great-grandfather set up the Malaysian tax system. So I think I'm possibly not your favorite person in any respect right now. There's two bits of disappointment I've given you in the space of 5 minutes, but there you go.
I don't think we can blame your grandfather, to be fair. This was all a lot of creative accounting that involved both, I think it was Goldman and KPMG, but you know.
There we go. Let's blame them.
So. We'll blame them, the bankers. We can blame them for everything. So I think you talked about this a little bit when you, sort of said, like, learning how to pitch for whom you're going to be speaking to, right? Like, so you talked about it from the perspective of writing the personal statement, but I guess this translates into how you prepare for an interview, because that was one of the questions I was going to ask, like, how can someone best prepare for a university interview, especially for those applying to Oxbridge, because we work with quite a lot of students applying to Oxbridge, as well as those applying to, you know, medicine, dentistry, that sort of thing.
Absolutely. Like with anything in sort of interviewing terms, the more prepared you are, the better it is. But also don't over prepare, because you've got to keep it a little bit natural as well within it. You don't want to be robotic in any sense. When it comes to things like medicine or Oxbridge and all of those sorts of things, the extra preparation you do in terms of the subject you're going into is vital, because you're up against academics who are world experts in their field. So actually, you're expected to know all of those bits. Where I would add an extra layer is actually the ability to be able to give a concise and succinct answer within there is an art form in itself. And often the best way I found doing this, and I took it from a medical example and it bleeds through obviously into the Oxbridge as well, is pair people up, but don't always pair people up based upon their common interests. It's far more interesting to have a mathematician explain a maths puzzle to a historian and to get them to understand it. And if they cannot understand it the first time, then you find a second way of trying to explain it. If it takes 5, 6, 7 goes, eventually you'll find what the best way of communicating that was. And that's an interview for you, is getting your idea across and getting someone else to understand it within there. We do it in medicine as a rule of thumb because it makes people work harder to actually get their point across. It started out as an idea from if you ever take an everyday action, like tying your shoelace or tying your tie, things that we take for granted, but you actually get someone else to do it and they can only follow your directions. They can't do any of it themselves. They have to listen exactly and follow absolutely everything you do. It's very tricky to start with, because you're rewiring your brain from what it expects through to what someone needs. And once you match those two things up, you become a lot better in an interview scenario, and you become a lot more natural with it as well. So as well as the preparation, all those sorts of things, what we've always done is to actually pair people together, sometimes based on common interest, because you can have a buddy who's also going for medicine, and every week you have to discuss something you've read in the news, and the two of you have to come up with something different, which is great because you are learning a little bit more. What we also do is pair you up with someone who's not, so that you can then work. Maybe it's a news article. You give them a news article one week, or the following week it's an everyday action, or the following week after that it's something from their course versus something from their course. You literally are saying to people, teach me. And if people work together, people see the interviews that you're in competition with each other, and therefore you're only single focused on yourself. Move away from that mentality and see that this is actually a team-based activity, because you're not going for the same place between the two of you. And even if you were going for the same place between the two of you, it's great that you're working together for that, because you might still both get that place. Where you isolate yourself and see it only as your single pursuit, you become too self-involved and too selfish, and you start fearing that interview more. If you actually enjoy the experience and the process that leads you up to it, in an interview, you'll find it a phenomenal experience to be in that particular room. So that's where I'd change the training side of things.
That is so interesting. I think it's definitely something that I'm going to speak to our, you know, interviewers about, the people who do our mock interviews, to kind of get that as something for the students to think about before they even begin their interview process. I was listening to a podcast recently about crypto, and I've always said, like, I don't know what blockchain is. Like, I have no idea. What are you talking about? And so this guy, the guy who made the podcast, he was really interesting. He said, you know, if I can explain this to my mom, who is a boomer, and if she understands this, then yeah, I'm communicating this well, because this is a really like technical concept that most people won't understand. But if I can get my mom, who's like 75, to understand this, then, you know, it should be easy enough for other people to get it. I still don't know what blockchain is, though. Never mind.
I was going to say, if you can explain blockchain and crypto to anyone, then you've automatically passed any interview in this world. I mean, I've been doing work with it for a while in terms of trying to actually work out how to harness it. And yet every time I'm in a conversation with someone who really understands it, I feel so amateur and so junior, because there are words there that still beat me. The fundamental concept I understand, but beyond that point, it's a fascinating world. It's just not one I'm completely geared up on yet. But there we go.
Yeah, hopefully one day it will make sense to me. And
yeah, but by the time it makes sense to us at that stage, there's something else, isn't there?
Yes, always something new to be aware of. I feel like you've sort of answered my question about, you know, how MPW prepares students for applications to top universities. You've kind of talked about a range of things around how to, you know, make sure you write a good personal statement. We've talked about the sorts of things you can do to prepare for an interview. So we'll move on to our last two questions. And okay. So the penultimate question is, you know, looking back on your life or career, is there anything that you think you'd do differently?
Ooh, I find it very dangerous to look back and to actually go. I mean, it, in some ways, it becomes fascinating going, if I had my time again, I'd be a lawyer. If I had my time again, I'd do this, that, and the other. And I don't know if I believe that. I think looking back, I wouldn't do anything differently because you learn from every single experience. It's such a cliched answer. You learn from every single thing along the way, and you've got to champion the things you've learned. And one thing I found fascinating in my inverted commas career so far is the fact that it has so many tangential, diverse routes and paths that I would only have found by going down the route that I've gone down at this moment in time. So if I'd had my time again, I probably wouldn't have broken my leg. But I mean, ultimately, in every other respect, I'm happy with the path and the route that I've taken because I've met the most incredible people. I've had the most incredible experiences. And with my eyes open to the whole thing, it's been a good career so far. So probably not in that particular respect. One thing I may have done that I've learned over the course of time is I might have become just a touch better at administration and therefore planning and those sorts of things, because I would say there's still some life lessons I need to learn, like being on time. But apart from that, in every other respect, no, probably wouldn't change anything.
Yeah, life admin sucks. They don't tell you when you're a kid that there's life admin.
Oh, no, do they ever? No, it's not what they're there for, is it? It's and who likes admin anyway? I mean, seriously. But
not me. I was saying to my sister the other day, I definitely need a PA. I double booked myself on Tuesday or Wednesday. I had a meeting with two guys, both called James, who showed up at the same time. And then our receptionist said, oh, Davina, James is here. So I was like, oh, hi, James. And it was not the James I was expecting to see. And then the other James showed up and I'm like, oh no, there are two Jameses here now and it's 11 a.m. Anyway.
I mean, there's always this thing in there that if in doubt, call someone James, because you've got a 50% chance of getting that right. And on behalf of Jameses everywhere, sorry that we have such a common name. But in some ways that can be helpful at times as well.
It was very helpful on the day. I'll be like, oh, hi, James. anyway. Okay. Yeah. So any last thoughts or advice for young people who are considering what they will be when they grow up?
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned a book you read earlier, actually, which is, you know, don't put too much pressure on yourself. And I think that has to be advice number one, is really don't put too much pressure on yourself. Society puts that pressure onto you. The world puts that pressure on you. We're too afraid to get things wrong. We're too afraid to make a mistake on the path that we choose. And we are a world of apologists. So we will always apologize for these sorts of things. And that does put a mental block in place. So the advice, very simply, is just be open and receptive and allow yourself to think in the here and now. Don't think of the 20-year plan. Don't think of the 10-year plan. Just have an idea as to what the next few years are. So if you're at the stage of school at this moment in time, albeit if you know you want to be a doctor, a dentist, a vet, an engineer, okay, your path is pretty much mapped out for you in terms of how that's going to work out. In every other respect, I will interview someone when they come into MPW. And at that point, most of the conversation will be about your university and what sort of things you enjoy in terms of your learning, your thinking, what subjects. Base it upon that and then see what happens at university, particularly the English education system. It champions skills more than it champions the actual subject itself, because employers will take you from the strength of the skills in the university that you come from. So you enjoy what you're studying at this moment in time and allow yourself to work out what you might want to be as time actually goes on. The biggest example of that is always business and economics that people want to go into, which largely means nothing when you are applying to university. It's just a term, but you'll find out whether you want to be an investment banker or an accountant or, you know, a geologist when you're actually at university itself. That will change. That will naturally change. So just don't be hard on yourself. Be open, be receptive. One of my favorite ever books is a book called The Exercises in Style by a French writer, Raymond Queneau, within that. And it tells the same story in 99 different ways. And all it does is change the pitch, the tone, the intonation, the style, all of these sorts of things. So the point being, that story can change. It will be one thing for one person, it'll be one thing for another person. Doesn't matter. It's which one of those 99 stories actually relates to you within there. But in order to find that out, you're going to have to go through quite a lot of these stories in order to get yourself to that point in the first place. So just be open to it. One other thing, though, and more critically than anything else, is take your time to research it. I will have respect for someone who will say, I don't know what I want to do in life, but I've actually looked at all of this and I know I don't want to do that, versus someone who just says, oh, I don't know, but hasn't looked into anything at all. That's laziness. Look into it, research it, get work experience, talk to people, listen. If you're going to actually talk to someone, listen to the answers that you're being given and work out how to adapt them for yourselves. But most importantly than anything else, try and remember what you were saying, Davina, which is one life, a little bit of fun within there. Don't put too much pressure. Family pressure will always exist in all of these sorts of things. But just because you're told you've got to be a doctor doesn't mean you know what kind of doctor you want to be yet. So don't choose that bit. Maybe leave that bit for a little bit of a surprise in 3 years' time. Just try and work with what you've got. But remember who you are and enjoy the process.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks for taking the time to chat with us today. I feel like I've learned a lot, so I imagine the students will feel like they'll have an opportunity to learn a lot from this chat. So thanks again, James. It's lovely to meet you.
Davina, thank you very much.
Take care. Bye.